Hello, and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 26th July, with me, Ian Welsh. We've got a bumper special for you this week. Coming up is the usual digest of some of what's happening in the sustainable business world. Plus, when I was in Brussels last month for Innovation Forum's Are Biofuels Sustainable conference, I spoke with the Roundtable on Sustainable Biomaterials, Stephen Wetmore. And I'm delighted to welcome a new voice to the podcast in the form of my colleague, Herfiza Kadabokas, who recently interviewed Anant Ahuja from the Good Business Lab about his work in Indian apparel factories and worker empowerment. So do keep listening. But first is a regular roundup of some recent business and sustainability news. The latest edition of the OECD and UN Food and Agriculture Organization's Agriculture Outlook predicts that global demand for agricultural products will grow by 15% over the coming decade, with productivity growth to increase slightly faster. Commodity prices are set to remain at or below current levels. Technological improvements are the likely cause of the predicted productivity boost, with land use for agriculture remaining constant. While greenhouse gas emissions are expected to rise 0.5% annually, this is below the 0.7% growth rate of the past 10 years. The growth rates indicate declining carbon intensity. Crucially, however, the report does highlight a number of emerging uncertainties. Trade tensions, the spread of disease in livestock and crops, antibiotic and antimicrobial resistance, changing climate and shifting regulation are among the challenges, as are moves towards more vegetable-based diets in response to growing obesity rates and general health. Indicating shifting trends in the agriculture sector more broadly, China's biggest food company, COFCO, has raised a $2.1 billion loan that links directly to environmental targets. Lower interest rates will be achieved in exchange for the business meeting sustainability-based targets such as tracing soil and supply chains to ensure they are deforestation-free. The deal is the largest in the commodities trading sector and one of the biggest ever sustainability-linked loans. Other traders, including Olam International and Wilmar, signed similar loans in the past couple of years. Same with agriculture. A new report from the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission in the UK says that the nation's food and farming system is in real trouble, requiring radical transformation in the coming decade to become truly sustainable. The report argues for farmers to be able to shift towards more organic and ecosystem-friendly production, growing more nuts and pulses, and moving livestock to becoming grass-fed. It blames the way that the agriculture systems in the UK have developed for breaking the links between the health of the land and the health of the population. There is a chink of light, however, as most farmers reckon that they can make the significant changes necessary if they are enabled to do so via better public policy and incentive structures. Announced this week, 28 companies with a market capitalisation of $1.3 trillion have committed themselves via the UN Global Compact to more ambitious global targets that align with limiting global warming to 1.5 Celsius and to reach net zero emissions by no later than 2050. Among the companies are AstraZeneca, BT, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, Levi Strauss, Natura and Unilever, aligning with the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report warning of catastrophic consequences should warming exceed 1.5 Celsius. The companies have challenged governments to match their ambition. Non-profit CDP, formerly known as the Carbon Disclosure Project, says that most big companies are failing to report their impacts on deforestation despite commitments to do so. Of the 1,500 companies that the CDP works with, 70% failed to provide data on forest impacts when asked to do so in 2018. Of the 306 that did respond, 24% showed no or limited action to cut deforestation despite the associated supply and reputational risks. This disclosure comes, of course, amid widespread acceptance that many companies will not meet 2020 zero deforestation goals. Elsewhere this week, apparel group Inditex, which includes high street brand Zara, has pledged to move to 100% sustainable, organic or recycled source materials by 2025, from current rates of around 20%. This seems fairly straightforward, but while such news is always welcome, as ever, the devil is in the detail, with many commentators questioning on social media and elsewhere the relative impacts of the alternatives. The law of unintended consequences coming into play once again, perhaps. There are three events coming up in Innovation Forum's Autumn Conference series. First up, we'll be back in Detroit on the 8th and 9th of October, where, joining us to discuss how to drive, measure and profit from sustainable innovation, will be experts from Bayer, Pirelli, Schneider Electric, Hilton, the NYU Stern School of Business and many more. And you can save $500 in conference passes if you reserve your place by 26th of July. The next in Innovation Forum's Future for Plastics event series will be in Amsterdam on 30th and 31st October, where we'll be joined by senior representatives from Reckitt Benckiser, Nestle, Walgreens Boots Alliance, Unilever, Coca-Cola, Ocado, Plastics Europe and many more. Book to join them by 26th July to save €300 on conference passes. And then on the 20th and 21st November in London, we'll be hosting this year's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum. Among those already confirmed to attend are the key people from Mondelez, Nestle, Golden Agri Resources, IKEA, Greenpeace, World Bank, Consumer Goods Forum and the World Resources Institute. Book by 2nd of August to save £300 on passes. Full details of all events and how to get involved are, as ever, in this week's newsletter and on the Innovation Forum website. Interview time now. When I was in Brussels recently, I met with Stephen Wetmore, Director of Business Development at the Roundtable for Sustainable Biomaterials. This morning we were talking about the sustainability of biofuels and managing the risk and thinking about how feedstocks can be scalable and sustainable. So, Stephen, from your perspective, what are the key feedstocks for biofuels and how can these become sustainable at scale?
We shouldn't be focusing on what are the key feedstock options. What we should be focusing on is how do we transition in a just transition? And when I mean just, I don't mean just for as a planet. I mean just as in terms of communities, nations as well. How do we transition to a low carbon economy? What is it going to take us to get us into that space? And if you work your way backwards through the SDGs, we've got 17 governing targets that states have wanting to adhere to. And then within our RSB, we have 12 sustainability principles that gives a voice and a meaning to how do we best achieve a net zero or even positive carbon economy by 2050. And how do we now regulate, in essence, and define and best choose and reduce the risks, both social, environmental, and economic risks that we may have in a choice of any form of feedstock. That should be the basis. We shouldn't be defining this is now sustainable and that is, because technologies are proving too fast, too incredible for us to limit ourselves to a particular feedstock. And as RSB, we've recognized that. We are feedstock agnostic. We're rather about the end game goal and how do we find solutions in creating that.
It's the case then, you need to look at feedstocks individually within the context of where they are and what they can achieve locally rather than thinking about them in terms globally.
Absolutely. I think the problem for us is the very statement about global. We look at climate change, and we look at carbon emissions, and we see that it's a global issue. So we start looking for a global solution. There isn't a global solution. What we have to start finding is local solutions. And if we want to drive scale, even scale at the local scenario. So it's not about first, what type of feedstock should we have? The question is, where do you want to do this? Where is that space? And then defining what is the best feedstock potential solution to drive a zero carbon economy.
So I guess that explains a little bit why you are the Roundtable for Sustainable Biomaterials rather than the Roundtable for Sustainable Biofuels.
Absolutely. So that was an intentional move a few years back, mainly driven by our environmental NGOs who recognized that the demand for biofeedstock is go beyond just that of fuels. It's entered into the plastic streams and so forth. For us to have a circular economy that is also critical to ensure a net zero or positive scenario, we're always going to need a virgin material entering a circular economy space. It's going to be 30-40% of a product. And to us to migrate from a fossil fuel, that's going to put a massive demand on materials and biomaterials. So it's typically NGOs like WWF that recognize this and said, hang on, RSB needs to go and migrate from fuels to biomaterials, broaden that scope, and realize that it's about driving a bioeconomy in support of this greater agenda and making sure that when we do it, that the materials are used, they're produced in the best possible sustainable ways, that they provide more value than simply the outcome of reduction of greenhouse gases that is there. But how can, while we're doing this, we only have this one time to get this right. How do we also generate socioeconomic benefits through that similar agenda and ensure that whatever form of material we have has a mass balance benefit?
The debate around second generation biofuels in particular is beset with endless series of unintended consequences. For example, when is it better to leave waste scrap residue in the field versus when is it okay to use an extract and turn to fuels and the carbon footprint of either approach? So how do we plot our way through these endless unintended consequences?
Our set of criteria, which is actually our standard, and then in our solutions that we have around advanced fuels or positive impact product standards that you may choose or the solutions that you may choose, by putting carbon first in the space, we're noticing that the markets actually manage themselves because we have soils, health of soils included in our standards. If you remove too much residue off the land, you're increasing your carbon emissions into that space. You're going to have to supplement it with either some other kind of fossil chemicals or arrangements into the farming processes. which is going to mean you can't report on reaching the goals of less greenhouse gas emissions. We're seeing businesses holding this holy grail of greenhouse gas emissions and having positive impacts, and it's managing themselves. But we're also realizing that there are always the cowboys out there. So looking at how we can use blockchain as a methodology to ensure that book and claim scenarios are correct. The best element of RSB is that it is a chain of custody process. So we, through the process, can at any stage identify, hang on, there wasn't that amount of residue that went into this space to justify this output. Or hang on, if you have done that, the greenhouse gas emissions implications back in the agricultural space shouldn't and couldn't have met that standard. And so it's not a valid outcome. So our chain of custody, I think, is our strongest mechanism for this person.
Regulation is something that came up in our session just now, and we were talking about what good regulation looks like in this space, but I wonder whether it's a little bit more about good regulation, but at the right level of government and the right place to have a sort of policy canvas that's not too rigid. Is that how you would characterize this?
Perfectly, perfectly stated. EU REDS 2, I would argue, is potentially too many elements that have been scoped, and that's restricting and can restrict innovation. I'd rather see a policy as a blank canvas. It provides the framework, here's the measurements. In our world, in the RSB would be the sustainability criteria, the 12 sustainability criteria embedded in that space. And I think as EU REDS, there's a bit of a too much of a limitation and too much of a focus on just greenhouse gas emissions. But that said, what we do like is that states now have the luxury to define what that 14% allocation should be in terms of the transport space. Every state should define that according to the best ways and the best contributions they can have as their commitments into the Paris agreements, not as an EU REDS framework and how we're going to meet that. They should lift their eyes above and say, what is my sustainability strategy for my nation and my contribution to the Paris agreements? And then the obvious in terms of prioritizing our use, because yes, we have to decrease the use of any natural resource going forward as a growing economy and as a growing population. We have to ask hard questions on where's the best place to use this carbon. It shouldn't be necessarily at ground transport. We're seeing it particularly in the European space. It should be somewhere around the aviation areas where there isn't another pathway for the next foreseeable 15 to 20 years to transition. And how do we support that economy?
And of course, RED is the EU Renewable Energy Directive. Just taking on from your point there, if we find ourselves with sectors competing for waste as a feedstock, how do we plot which sector should take priority for that stock?
Again, best use of carbon. And to what degree can they meet that sustainability criteria? And the sustainability criteria have to take socioeconomic elements into account as well. I used this case when I spoke earlier, but technically, if you only use carbon, then if we took plastics out of the ocean and we recycled that into a fuel or even back into a plastic, if it was possible, it would meet the carbon emissions constraints within the EU REDS. By default, then we'd say, well, it's best left in the ocean. And we know that's not the case. We need to extract that out of the ocean and ensure that it's not entering our ocean as well. And so we need to look at the implications, the socioeconomic benefits of driving it. And EU REDS hasn't technically addressed that, and why we would encourage people, especially companies, big brands, to align their sustainability strategies to that of an RSB. You'll find all the principles reflected from the SDGs and not just be governed by policy, but rather be governed by objectives that are going to move us towards a low carbon economy by 2050. Below 1.5 degrees.
The answer to my question was the best use of carbon, but how do you define the best use of carbon? How do you find what the best use of carbon is? What, is it that using the SDGs to do that?
LCAs in terms of all product options and how that product or that use is helping and stimulating a circular economy. But there are, by default, some sectors that are going to have to use carbon, like the aviation sector. It's going to burn it. It's not going to be reused. But then back in a biomaterial space, there is sequestration that's taking place through the biomass that's been generated for that. So there's a sense of circularity, but we've got to be honest, there's carbon emissions. But every sector needs to define their just transitional approach, science-based targets.
It's certainly a fascinating area. I mean, the more one talks about biofuels, the more complicated the system seems to be. But there's loads of exciting innovations and lots of things going on at different levels, and it's really exciting to be talking about them. But Stephen Metmore from RSB, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
In London recently, my colleague Herfiza Kadaboukas met with Anant Ahuja from the Good Business Lab.
Grant, why don't you start things off by giving us a bit of background on Good Business Lab?
So Good Business Lab, or GBL as some people call it, is essentially a social innovation lab. And we work with firms in labor-intensive sectors to find the sort of sweet spot where business interests and worker interests meet. We sort of do research around these topics to find places of alignment between these issues and then promote them through communication as well as by applying these learnings in workplace settings.
Interestingly, your involvement in the apparel sector stretches beyond Good Business Lab. Your grandmother set up Shahi Exports in 1974, which is now India's biggest apparel export house. Can you explain your involvement with this company?
So I joined Shahi back in 2013, and I was interested to learn about the business, understand how it works. And what I understood from talking to different people within the firm was there's a lot of problems and challenges that the business is trying to solve. Depending on who you talk to, those could range from a whole host of issues. But the one common issue that I heard across most of the people I spoke to was the challenges around managing such a large workforce. The garment industry in general is a labor-intensive sector, and it historically has employed low-income, unskilled women. So because of this sort of situation, there is a large focus on labor policies, labor management. It's an area that, although requires a lot of attention, doesn't necessarily have a lot of expertise and research behind it.
And something I think our listeners would be really interested to hear about is to what extent you think Shahi Export is complicit in the problems that Good Business Lab is trying to address in the garment industry.
If you look at the history and legacy of Shahi, there's always been this focus on empowering workers and women in particular, especially because my grandmother was a female garment worker herself and built this company sort of from the ground up. With that said, the company has grown a lot, especially in the last 10 years. When I joined in 2013, the workforce was around 60,000 people. Today, it's closer to 120,000 people. And in that sense, there are a lot of challenges the company faces. Just as an example, worker turnover is really high. So every month, a large percentage of the workforce leaves due to various issues. And I think that even beyond that, we've faced issues on areas such as industrial relations, and we've been criticized for these issues as well. So more than anything, what this exemplifies is the, you know, recognize that even companies with the right intentions will face challenges. And instead of shying away from talking about them, actually being open and transparent to source the right solutions and figure out the right way going forward. When you have that philosophy and approach, then something like Good Business Lab becomes a really strong asset because it's essentially quantifying and putting a scientific lens on testing different solutions. And then coming back to Shahi with some great feedback in terms of how to invest resources, how to think about challenges, and how to really look at problems holistically in the long term from both the worker point of view as well as the firm perspective.
When we met in Amsterdam, you mentioned that Gap and Shahi collaboratively set up the Personal Advancement and Career Enhancement Program, so the PACE program. Could you tell me a bit more about the role that this program plays in addressing a lot of the issues in the garment industry?
Gap is one of Shahi's brand partners. Shahi and Gap have been working together for many years. And back in 2006, they approached the Shahi management and said, look, we're interested to create a program and invest in female garment workers. And these are some ideas we have. So they brought a bunch of stakeholders to the table, everyone from ICRW, the International Center for Research on Women, Swasti, which is a local NGO, Shahi as the supplier partner, and everyone started collaboratively working on program ideas to solve the problem of the lack of soft skills, awareness, and training that existed for this specific demographic. The philosophy at the time was that by investing in women, that we could create a much larger impact in the community and society. So that was the kind of premise that Gap had at the time. Through those efforts, the PACE program was created, which essentially is a soft skill training for female garment workers that covers topics such as communication, time management, financial literacy, legal literacy, problem solving, decision making, a lot of the sort of life skills that people develop through experiences and education. But in a large sense, this particular demographic did not necessarily have access to or get the opportunity to sort of experience and develop. Traditionally, I think garment companies would, for example, invest in the technical training of their workers. Obviously, they need to know how to sew or do whatever operation they're hired to do. But through this program, it was a completely different approach where Gap said, let's invest in a different sort of side of training. Let's think of training more holistically. When Good Business Lab came into the picture, this was about 5 years after Shahi and Gap started rolling out PACE. PACE had already become a sort of flagship program in Shahi's factories. And anecdotally, there were stories about the impacts that it had, whether PACE-trained workers were becoming stronger leaders or taking more responsibility or just had good feedback from their supervisors in general. So at this point, Good Business Lab started wondering what the advantages for a firm like Shahi would be to invest in this type of initiative. Clearly, there's a social impact angle, but was the firm itself benefiting from doing this? And that's kind of where we came up with the idea to rigorously test the business impacts of a program like PACE.
So you mentioned, briefly the impacts of this program. You obviously went on to do academic research completely separate of Shahi and Gap to look at the financial returns that the companies would benefit from. Could you explain a bit more about what the direct results were of this program?
We had the opportunity to actually design rigorous evaluation, which came in the form of a randomized controlled trial experiment, where we took a group of 3,000 workers across 5 factories and gave a treatment sample of this group, the PACE program. And the other sample was a control group, which wasn't given PACE. So we had an ability to kind of compare the outcomes of both of these groups. And what we saw was quite a large impact, larger than what we expected at the time. But essentially, the PACE-trained workers became 12% more productive than the non-PACE-trained workers. And through the improvements in their attendance, along with the improvements in productivity, we saw a return on investment of over 250% about 12 months after the program. So this is the kind of number that none of us expected to see, but at the same time made sense based on a lot of the stories we were hearing and the, you know, anecdotal evidence that existed. What this made clear to us was that PACE was more than just a social program. It was actually a business tool as well.
And so in your opinion, what are the wider implications of the results of this research when it comes to dealing with complex social issues within the supply chain?
When it comes to sustainability, we have a good sense of how to measure environmental sustainability and improvements in how companies perform in this area. Whereas with social issues, it gets a bit more complex. But applying these rigorous research methodologies through randomized control trials and other methodologies we use, we're now able to actually quantify impacts of programs and figure out which solutions are actually worth investing in, because the reality is firms have limited resources, and even if a firm wants to do the right thing, in some sense that's not enough, because it shouldn't just be focused on that. It should also be looking at the smart thing to do, and the smart thing to do is something that is sustainable financially as well. On the one hand, this research allows firms to effectively allocate their resources into impactful programs, programs that actually show impact, but also allows us to track our progress on how we're dealing with social issues. So, for example, in this case, we were addressing the issue of the lack of soft skills, and we found an effective way to deliver the soft skills. And this investment also benefited the firm enough to kind of incentivize them to continue to scale it up across their factories.
Great. Well, taking a step back and looking at the wider context in which you're working, how much do cultural sensitivities shape your work?
I think with GBL, our focus has always been to source disruptive ideas. And part of this comes from the academic side. So we're constantly in touch with the academic community and reading papers and understanding what's coming out of research globally. Part of it is also talking to management. So being on the shop floor, being in the factories, talking to people, understanding what they're thinking. Ultimately, where we find the most kind of value is sourcing ideas from the ground up. So really talking to the workforce, even co-creating solutions with the workers so that when we do implement something and test it, it really is the right fit for the factory or the right fit for the population where we're studying.
So looking into the future, what does Good Business Lab have planned for the next, let's say, 5 years?
We have an experimental nature and we continue to explore new approaches, new collaborations, innovations on our processes. And we're looking to apply this across a lot of different problem areas. Until now, our focus has largely been on studying the garment industry, factories within Shahi's supply chain. But the real vision is to be able to work with companies beyond just the garment industry. Like I mentioned, any labor intensive sector, any industry where workers are a focus and exist in large numbers. Within that framework, we hope to add more nuance to debates around topics such as living wages, flexible work arrangements, how companies can address financial inclusion for their workforce, and then addressing health more holistically. So whether that means mental health, of course, physical health, these are all areas that we continue to design research for within Shahi's factories. And now Good Business Lab has actually had the opportunity to work with some firms in Latin America outside of the garment industry, everything from food retail to cement and car manufacturing. And this is kind of bringing to life our earlier vision of really applying the learnings that we take from maybe the garment industry or that we've gathered until now and using it to sort of change the way business is done, the way firms think about business, the way they think about their investments and what incentives they have to actually invest in their workforce.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Anant. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. This is great.
Don't forget, the details of all the exciting events we've got coming up this autumn are on the Innovation Forum website and in this week's newsletter, including information on the discounts available right now. The podcast is going to take its annual summer break for a couple of weeks, but that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next month.